on this episode of the C4SO podcast.
First and foremost, I don't know if I could be a pastor without Alpha. I probably wouldn't. Or I have to think of something else, because you know, the Sunday worship gathering is so beautiful. But we all know deep down that it's best served by feeding Christians. And when we try and dumb it down for non-Christians too much, no one's really happy. And it doesn't really work. We make sure our Sunday services do welcome newcomers and non-Christians, but fundamentally we're feeding the flock of Christ.
Hi, I'm Mickey Lowe.
Hi, I'm Bishop Todd. And welcome to the C4SO podcast.
Hello, everybody. Bishop Todd here. And welcome to this last in our series of practical ministry, where we wrap it up with a really interesting, informative, I would say, conversation with Gare Jones. Gare is an Englishman who comes from a long line of evangelicals who care about doing evangelism through the power of the Spirit and in a way that centers evangelism in and for the church. So Gare is arguably one of the best practitioners of Alpha in America. Vintage LA has one of the best, most effective Alpha courses in America. And so today we get to talk to Gare from kind of the most conceptual about evangelism and why it matters and how it works in 2024, 2025, but also get into some of the practical aspects of how Alpha works in a local church and how Alpha is actually transformative in a very good way of church culture. Here's our conversation with Gare Jones.
Hey, Gare, welcome back to the C4SO podcast.
Thanks, Todd. Good to be back. Hey, yes. Mickey.
Tell everybody a little bit about your English upbringing. Just first of all, kind of where you're from, just whatever hits your brain this afternoon about your English upbringing.
Well, I was raised in the north of England, so cold but beautiful. And I think two things really shaped me growing up. The first was I was raised in a very dynamic church environment. My father was a church planter. And so we saw lots of churches planted, and we saw God move significantly. At the same time, we were living in a very secular post-Christian context where none of my friends were Christians in school. Youth group was the only place where I knew Christians. And so it was very dynamic because we knew the opposition to the Christian faith and the church. And at the same time, we saw God do incredible things, and multiple churches were planted. So it was... really, it formed me in such a powerful way to see the power of God in action, as well as see the great need of evangelism in a secular context. And so those two things shaped me significantly growing up, as well as, of course, the beautiful rolling hills of northern England.
Yeah, so cool. What do you miss most? Like, would it be a kind of food? Would it be proper football? Would it be the beauty?
We moved to LA in 2011, and so haven't been in England for a while, but we go every year, and there's always some rituals we do because we go to a pub and have a nice pint of warm bitter. We then go get an Indian curry, and then we get some fish and chips, and then we walk along the countryside. And so those are kind of the four things I have to do every time I go.
Of course, that sounds iconic.
Yeah.
Okay. Like a dream. So now that you're a little bit LA, what have you come to love in LA that kind of surprises you?
I'll tell you the biggest thing. There's a few things that surprise me here, which I've grown to love. The first is the freedom of individuality has its downsides, but everything is normal here in Los Angeles. And so
that's right,
you can unapologetically express your personality without having to confine to any cultural norms, which is very different to what I grew up with in England.
Right. Yeah.
That's lots of fun. And then secondly, I tell you, I'm massively into the outdoors and wilderness and backpacking. And in LA, you've got this amazing geography of got year-round wilderness, where whether it be Catalina Islands, whether Joshua Tree, Death Valley, the High Sierra, Big Sur. Right. California is like the geography of the whole world in a state, and it's absolutely stunning to live here.
Right.
Yeah, people don't get that. You know, you think of that lyric, they paved paradise and put up a parking lot. Everybody just thinks of LA as, you know, freeways and asphalt parking lots, but you're right. It's surrounded by great beauty. That's cool. Glad you enjoy it.
I mean, ultimately, that's why we pay extra taxes here.
So. Yeah, that's right. Keep those trails going. All right, Gary. So today we're going to be talking about evangelism. And I thought we might start by tell us quickly, how did you come to faith?
Great question, Todd. I grew up in the church and had some pretty significant encounters with Jesus and seeing him in action, both externally and in the lives of other people. I saw miracles growing up. Mm. I saw just incredible moments of the Holy Spirit moving. Together with had my own kind of childlike and teenage experiences and encounters of Jesus, and he was very real. And so by the time I went to college, my faith, I would have said then, was very secure. Very rich in its integrity. And it wasn't until I went to university that I hit some road bumps, some speed bumps for the first time, but that was more around the church, to be honest, than about my relationship with Jesus. And so those speed bumps became roadblocks, and I left for a while. My faith growing up was very much in the reality of seeing Jesus do stuff, either people meeting him profoundly, delivering them addictions. Yeah. We saw demonic deliverances growing up, and it was, you couldn't deny the power and reality of Jesus.
Yeah.
It was pretty intoxicating at times.
How did you find that working with unavoidable content side of Christian faith, not doctrine in that sort of legalistic sense, but just working together, like seeing God in action, as you say, and like taking on new beliefs and new understandings. Like, how did you find those things working together?
In my own life?
Yeah.
Well, it was always a mixture of the head and heart kind of helping each other out. I mean, as far as I lived in the reality of Jesus moving in power. And then as I grew older, my mind was wanting to understand kind of doctrine more, understand apologetics more, catch up with the experience. Mm-hmm. And but what was interesting is the experience never let me run away, even if the questions and the answers were challenging to my intellectual kind of a journey. Yeah. So I would say it was the head and the heart always informed the other. It was vital. Mm. And I always say to people now, you know, when we come to evangelism, it's never just the head. It's never just the heart. For deep and lifelong transformation, the conversion happens in both those spaces.
Yeah.
Mm. So true. Thanks for sharing, Gary. That sounds like a really vibrant faith that you were brought into and raised in. And it seems like it has really shaped you and your life. And we love to hear that. And maybe now give us sort of an orientation of your current context of planting Vintage LA, and especially as it relates to ensuring that evangelism was in the DNA of this church and part of the culture.
I think it's a great question, because the DNA of evangelism was at the heart of our church, because it was the heart of my wife and I. And Acts 16, we find Paul on the edge of Turkey in a place called Troas, wondering where to go. And the Macedonian man called him westward to come and help. And that was our call to Los Angeles, was the city is crying out for help. They may not know they need Jesus, but everything about this city is a cry for help. And we felt that our job was to bring Jesus to people who are lost and lonely and hurting and suffering with mental health challenges, with poverty, with addictions, with so we felt that actually we're going to LA not for the sake of Christians, but for the sake of the lost. Now we need to get, in order to reach the lost, you have to actually disciple a community into being a kingdom, radically alternative society that non-Christians can come into it. But it was the end goal has always been for people to come to know Jesus and to be healed and found by him. And so when we arrived, we recognized that most church planting, sadly, and most church planting books, sadly, don't have the lost in mind. They have sheep stealing in mind. And so we had to re-engineer some things around, well, how do we plant a church that doesn't just become feeding disaffected sheep from other churches in a new way? How do we actually reach the lost? And so there were some things we did at the very start, which were difficult, but we endured with them to make sure that Christians coming to us, which we believe God can shuffle sheep around churches. We believe that he does that. But we wanted to make sure that anybody who came to Vintage would recognize and know that we are missionally oriented to the lost and not just delivering a different set of religious goods and services and hopefully a nice set of that.
Mm. Yeah. So, Gare, I know because you sit in these sort of rooms, so I know you know this too, that if you put 20 pastors in a room or 20 church leaders in a room, probably 19 of them are going to say, wow, evangelism is just so hard these days. Mm-hmm. And if it's anybody, you know, sort of past middle age who has some experience, you know, they're going to say, gosh, it's harder than any time in my couple of decades of ministry or whatever. So I wonder if you could go use the specific of LA to maybe help us understand some universals. So give us, what are two or three of the biggest issues of faith today that you're finding in LA and how you think that maybe, you know, works its way across America as well?
Yeah, I think fundamentally LA is one of the leading cities in America that I found helpful to describe as post-Christendom, which is people are maybe have been brought up with faith or they've been brought up in a Christian context or at least a Christian culture, but they've positively decided not to go that direction. So they're moving away from Jesus and intentionally so. It's like I said to people, if you don't like sushi, like you tried it, I don't like it. So you're never going to try it again. It's like, I want to do something else. And so a whole city is going, we're open to other things, but not Jesus. And so we're open to other forms of spirituality, but we've done the Jesus thing and we've rejected it. So now we're moving on. And so this whole city is like that. I mean, whether that is antagonistically or maybe even not in a kind of an antagonistic way, but just a sense of respectful way. Mm-hmm. People are not considering Jesus if they're considering spiritual things. There has been a great awakening to spirituality, not just in LA, but around the country, particularly post-COVID. But it's non-Jesus spirituality and intentionality, and that's very much in people's minds. Together with, most people find the church quite toxic, whether it be through their engagement with politics or press or scandals in the church, that they actually think Christianity is harmful for society, not beneficial. It's not neutral, nor is it beneficial.
Yeah.
So those are two things. I think people are running away from Christianity. Secondly, they think it's toxic. And thirdly, they don't want anybody to kind of help change their opinion about spiritual things. It's very much a pluralistic context where self-autonomy, you know, Charles Taylor, secular age stuff, where people go, we all want to just define our own thing because we don't believe in truth anymore. So in its very essence, we actually don't believe in religion. We just believe in our own version of it.
Yeah. Yeah, so my own sense of being spiritual.
Yeah, yeah. And the last thing I'm ever going to do is listen to anybody tell me what to believe. I need to define what I believe, and that's as equally valid for me as it is for you. So it's a very fascinating postmodern, post-Christendom, post-truth environment, coupled with a rejection of Christianity and a rejection of the church.
Yeah, that's super helpful, Gare, because you know, when I was young, and this is probably true for you too, even though we're a decade or more apart in age, is, you know, it used to be, well, if I could understand that the Bible was true, or if I could come to believe, to see that the resurrection was valid, then I would come to faith. Those sort of apologetic questions are very different than, is the church a source of evil or not? Those are just radically different questions that people are asking today.
Yeah, the rational apologetics, the evidence-based apologetics have been undermined for years. They were destroyed in COVID because people in COVID had a real crisis around healthcare, obviously COVID, and then they saw so-called experts disagreeing with each other. and giving science to back up different views. And it really exposed that people just don't trust authority anymore. They don't trust evidence-based for anything. True. It's like, give me 10 reasons for the resurrection. Don't care. I'm sure someone else can give me 10 reasons not for the resurrection.
Yeah,
they fundamentally don't believe in any of the modernistic ways of doing apologetics. Like the case for Christ, don't care. I'm sure there's a case for Buddha as well. You know?
Yeah.
What is interesting is experientially show me that Jesus is true, because he's a source of good. Yeah. He's a source of beauty. He's a source of well-being. Yeah. And so one person put it this way. They said, you know, we used to say and help people discover that Jesus is true, good and beautiful. Well, we have to reverse that order and show Jesus is beautiful, good, and then finally true.
And true.
And it's what I think Blaise Pascal, as I summarize, said, you know, talk about Jesus in a way that people want it to be true and then show them it's true. And I think that's the evangelistic task now. People need hope. They need answers to their real problem, experiential issues in their life. And that's the only doorway into Jesus, because intellectually and scientifically, they don't care much.
Well, related to this question, Gare, is, again, something that all church leaders know, is that the average Christian is afraid to engage in evangelistic conversations. Now, again, there are exceptions to every rule. But knowing what you just said, you know, the sort of that caricature that we drew, it's understandable that people are kind of afraid to engage. What are you hearing from people today when they try to explain to you why they're nervous, afraid, tense, you know, whatever word they might use to engage in evangelistic conversations?
I think it used to be that people were afraid to engage because they may be seen, they may run up against their lack of competency of helping people with their questions. And that's still valid. I think the deeper fear now is if I come out as a Christian to my friends, or if I try and talk about Jesus to my friends, I will lose that friendship. I will lose a friend, because it's rude, it's intolerant of their belief. They will see me as proselytizing them and breaching the number one rule of life in Los Angeles, which is you be you, I'll be me, and we'll love each other in how we self-define. And so any type of trying to help you become someone different to who you currently are is offensive and is not love. And so people are just, they don't know how to evangelize. They don't even know whether they should evangelize. And they certainly think, if I do evangelize, I'm putting at risk my relationship with my friend, my relationship with my neighbor, and my relationship with my colleague. I may lose my job over this. There's a real fear, and which we have to empathize with. We can't just go, hey, just be more bold. We really have to help people of what it therefore looks like in a context where you could lose your friend if you evangelize. That's a real risk. That's not a fictional risk.
Yeah, or to be seen as intolerant, or to be seen as evil or toxic or harmful, even, as you mentioned, Gary, and the sort of the issues of faith that you're dealing with there in LA. As Bishop Todd and I were prepping it, that's just something that came to mind, you know? The fears.
What's fascinating, though, about LA is I think 5 years ago, if you came out as a Christian, you would be seen as intolerant and unfriendly and mean, like the people with the microphones on TV. I think actually most non-Christians now think that's almost a parody of people on TV. They recognize now that with all the scandals, it's probably just a few. So if you came out as a Christian now in LA, they would just think you're a nice version of it. But just keep it to yourself. They're no longer thinking you're a mean, horrible person, because they realize, we can't generalize, but there are mean, horrible Christians. They just generally see it as like saying, I like vanilla ice cream, you like chocolate. Great. Just as long as you don't try and force me to eat vanilla, you know?
Yeah.
Fascinating, yeah.
It's pretty neutral now. Whereas 5 years ago, people would be quite rude to Christians as being toxic in society. I think LA's gone beyond that now to as long as we're all nice people and don't try and convert each other, we're all good.
Yeah. It feels as though, like, in my context here in Tampa, whenever we do come across, like, my husband and I have tons of friends who are not believers. He grew up in the music community here. And so most of our friends outside of the church are just not Christians. And so for us, they know what we do. They know what we believe in. But they see us as the exception, right? They don't. They're like, okay, Mickey and Travis are cool. Like, you know, they have their thing, but they're not like the others. And so that's kind of what we're dealing with here on this side, is you guys are cool and you're nice because, you know, you don't, you know, aren't rude or whatever about it. But it's pretty hostile where I'm at.
I think that's the first stage, isn't it, of evangelism in a hostile environment, is particularly where there's been perceptions of what Christians are like. As one person said, the first step of evangelism is helping your friends see you as the first Christian they like. Mm. You know, and then hopefully the first, then trust, then see something which is compelling.
Building that relationship.
Then see something they want, and then eventually be curious about asking. But it begins with being the first Christian that people actually like.
Totally. And you have to be in it for the long haul too. You know, you have to be in it for that long-term relationship building.
Slow evangelism out here in LA.
Yeah.
It's just, it's slow evangelism, which is beautiful. Yep. I mean, I love slow evangelism because you get to take people on the journey, but it is slow. And once you embrace slow as not bad, but just different, then you actually really enjoy it. I mean, we have people do alpha 3 or 4 times as they move toward Jesus slowly. And that's not a bad thing. It's just, Jesus hung out with his disciples for 3 years. It's slow evangelism, you know, and some things that are slow are really beautiful, you know. I'm sure Todd slow cooks his brisket in his backyard sometimes, and it's just that slow roast is going to bring out the flavor.
Ooh, Debbie would be high-fiving you. That's her thing. She smokes the brisket.
Wow. Yes. I love that.
But I think that's a real thing. I think part of evangelism in today's secular post-Christendom age begins with the Christian redefining their expectations of what evangelism is. And if you insist on quick evangelism, you'll never embrace the task, the missional task today, which is why actually we never take metrics and compare to old school methods of raising hands on Sunday. It's like, dude, we're living in a different context. You can't, it's not apples to apples anymore. I mean, an atheist who comes back to Alpha Week 2, that's a massive victory for us. You know, we're not just counting hands. We're counting the person who actually, you know, suffered abuse from a pastor growing up, that they felt for the first time they could actually come back to church at Vintage. That's a victory, you know? And so we have to help people redefine what the evangelistic task is.
Okay, so you mentioned Alpha, and that's, you know, also part of why Bishop Todd and I wanted to sit down with you, Gare, and talk to you about this program. So tell us, why do you feel like Alpha works so well? What is its magic? You have lots of experience with Alpha. So tell us what you've seen over the years.
Well, Mickey, first and foremost, I don't know if I could be a pastor without Alpha. I probably wouldn't. Or I have to think of something else, because, you know, the Sunday moment, the Sunday worship gathering is so beautiful. But we all know deep down that it's best served by feeding Christians. And when we try and dumb it down for non-Christians too much, no one's really happy. And it doesn't really work. We make sure our Sunday services do welcome newcomers and non-Christians, but fundamentally we're feeding the flock of Christ. Mm-hmm. And we're sensitive to non-Christians. But none of us want to dumb down Sundays. And so we ran into a question. It's like, well, if Sundays are predominantly to disciple our church family, how on earth are we ever going to reach the lost? And we in this cultural moment with all the challenges. And so we recognized that something like Alpha became a second Sunday gathering for us that is not on Sundays, it's on Tuesday night, but it is just as important as a Sunday gathering, because that's our gathering for those who don't know Jesus. It's for those who is catered for them to explore Jesus, to taste and see that the Lord is good. And because our Sundays weren't able to do that, and our community groups are certainly not able to do that. Mm. And friendship evangelism is no way able to do that in today's challenges. So we run Alpha, as we say it, as our second Sunday service. Our Sunday is predominantly for Christians, but hospitable for non-Christians. And our Tuesday night is predominantly for non-Christians to come and go on a journey of exploring Jesus. And so, like Jesus had the 12 and he had the crowd, and sometimes spoke to everyone, sometimes just spoke to the 12. Alpha is our way to talk to our city. It is actually to help them explore. And so we didn't invent it. We got it off the shelf. This is an amazing tool. I know nothing else like it. And in my context, without it, I would just be speaking to Christians and managing the slow decline of a Christian community in Los Angeles. So Alpha is essential for us. So we run Alpha. We ran it at the very start of our church plant. And we've seen it's hard. It's expensive, just like Sunday mornings are hard and expensive. But we've seen God do incredible things through it, because I think he anoints, doesn't he, when we are joining him in his mission. And his mission is not only to make disciples of existing Christians, but to make disciples of non-Christians. And so we've seen God really move powerfully.
Amen.
So, Gary, most of the listeners here would be somehow attached to C4SO, and you'll be doing a couple-hour seminar at our upcoming pastors' conference. So anybody who's attached to C4SO as a leader will have that to look forward to, but not everybody who listens to the podcast fits that profile. So there's lots of training. If you just Google Alpha, you'll find lots of training. But just kind of to whet people's appetite today, I mean, you and I have seen great Alpha courses all over the country, and you have seen them all over England. And so we know their amazing potential, but you also know, because of all the training you do, that lots of churches try it once and they kind of give up for various reasons. So just kind of whet people's appetite a little bit here. What are the typical barriers that a church has to overcome to run a successful course, to get the momentum going?
It's a great question. It's why we run our masterclass twice a year, because there's so many churches we go. We buy into the theory of this, but we just don't see it working. And so we run these all-day, two-day workshops, masterclass here to help people, because we had to go on that journey ourselves. We struggled in LA for a season to get Alpha up and running, and we had to go back to the drawing board, not to change the recipe of Alpha, but to actually look at how we can run it in 21st century Los Angeles. And we saw some great strides, actually. And, you know, there's like 30 things we had to do, which is what the masterclass is about. A few highlights of that. I think number one was to see it as a second Sunday, that this is just as important as our Sunday gathering. This is not small group ministry, or this is how we speak to our city. And therefore, we are going to put resources, we're going to put staff behind it. Secondly, and fundamentally, we had to make Alpha an environment where non-Christians were safe and had fun and found friends. Yeah. What we realize is most Alphas, including the one we were running, it felt so unsafe for non-Christians. It was in a venue that felt scary. The small groups were very Christian. There were other Christians in the group who had Bibles, or very other Christians trying to teach and preach at them in small group conversations. The talks were a bit rubbish. It was like, why am I going to this on a Tuesday night? It's just a bit late. And so what we recognized was, if we were honest with ourselves and we asked churches to be honest with themselves, would a non-Christian love your Alpha course even if they didn't believe it? Would they love it? Would they find love, hospitality, safety to say whatever they want? Would they find people there good at talking with non-Christians? What we find is that most churches run Alpha that only Christians enjoy and not non-Christians, which mean no one actually then invites their friends to it, because they know actually our Alpha course really isn't kind of curated well enough for non-Christians.
Right.
So we work really hard to make sure Alpha feels like it's a third space, it's a neutral space. No Christians are allowed on it from our church, because basically Christians don't know how to behave around non-Christians on the whole. And so we've had to work really hard to convince our church that you can invite your friend to this and they will have a brilliant time, even if they don't end up following Jesus. So we've worked really hard. And the other thing is we do a launch night, which is just a one-off event where non-Christians can come and just check it out for themselves before they commit to it. That was a big game changer because no one in our city commits to anything because it's such a fluid work environment here. Yeah. No one commits to anything.
Yeah.
Makes sense. We have to, and I think actually most people like that. Most non-Christians want to sample something before they sign up to something. And so, yeah, we did about, those are three things we did of around 30, which we recognized we had to do to see Alpha really thrive.
That's awesome. And I'm sure that in your experience that running Alpha courses have enhanced the overall vibe of your church, right? It tell us more about how it's influenced the culture of your church, maybe like the missional mindset that it has. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, I think what comes to mind is, you know, it's one thing for the followers of Jesus to see Jesus do miracles, and that was exciting. It was a whole different experience when he sent out the 72 and God used them to see miracles. And they came back to Jesus going, "You never guess what happened." He went, "Well, I kind of know what happened." But there was a different level of excitement about mission when God used them. And I think what we see at Vintage is there's this beautiful kind of halo effect across the whole church when people do Alpha, because they see God at work in their group. They see God at work on the Alpha retreat in their conversations with their Alpha group. And that then becomes a game changer for them because it's like, oh my gosh, God is real. God works. God does things. This is amazing. Mm-hmm. And it also helps them have a real empathy to non-Christians that they never had before. One of the biggest things I've seen in our church, lots of people for various, I'm sure, good reasons have quite, or maybe not, have a bit of like a them and us mentality towards the non-Christian. Particularly in the culture wars, we have a, we don't like them. Yeah. We're afraid of them because they're taking away our country. What Alpha does, it actually softens that and gives people a love for the non-Christian because they hear the stories behind why people believe what they believe. And I say to people, look, no one ever comes to a position of faith neutrally. It's always through pain and trauma. And so when you're in your Alpha group and you're listening to an atheist say, this is what happened to me when I was six, when I went to church, or this is what happened to my mum and dad. Where was God when my younger brother died of cancer at the age of three? You suddenly go, oh my gosh, how can I not have love here? This is not my enemy. Even if they're an enemy of Christ, this is someone that Christ has called me to love. And I genuinely have love for this person. And so we've seen actually just generally the church have love towards the city as opposed to fear of the city and fear of their kind of Christendom being eroded. It's been a beautiful shift where people now go, I've never loved non-Christians like I have.
No, I love that you say that. And I love what you said a little bit earlier, that one of the first steps in evangelism is being the sort of Christian that gives non-Christians the ability to see this as something that's plausible, to live like this in a way that makes sense, that reflects the love of Christ. But as a church, what would you say is a good first step to prioritize and engage evangelism?
I think I go back to Acts 16 when God gave Paul a vision of a man of Macedonia. That was the first step. It was the first step of seeing a man from Macedonia who would have looked like they had it all together because it was a cultural elite of the time. And yet, what was this man doing in the vision? He was begging for help. And I think Paul was so emotionally disturbed by that and so brokenhearted, because it says in the next verse, so we decided at once to leave for Macedonia. There was something so visceral about that vision that Paul's heart was broken. And, you know, the first step is your heart broken for the lost? I mean, it begins there, because if you have that, then everything else just drives itself, because you're, as Paul said elsewhere, compelled by love for God so loved the world, for the joy set before Jesus, he endured the cross. It's, do you actually have a brokenness in your heart for those who don't know Jesus? Do you know, do you remember what it was like not to know him? Do you remember, I mean, can you imagine what it's like to face the challenges of life and family and marriage without Jesus? And once you ask the Lord just to break my heart like you broke Paul's, then you find yourself in a different position of going, well, what do we do? We've got to do something. I mean, we've got to do something.
Yeah.
We can't not do something. We can't go back to the church as normal. And I find, as the senior pastor, that's my responsibility more than anyone else's, is to keep saying, Lord, never let my heart grow cold for the lost. Let me walk around the streets where I am and just see behind the doors. Let me imagine, show me what's going on behind those doors. That I would actually never get complacent and just do Bible studies for Christians. Let me break my heart constantly like you broke Paul's. Because then I think actually the rest is easy, because it's just, okay, what? Tell me what to do.
Right.
Yeah.
Love it.
So, Gara, again, I know you're in rooms all the time with church leaders of various kinds, helping them think about local church-based evangelism and specifically think about the Alpha Course. And I know from the years I spent training people in Alpha Course things that, you know, so many people hear this and their kind of first gut instinct is guilt, shame, maybe a sense of impotence. Let's close our time together by your own journey. And as you've observed others, give us some words, give our listeners some words of confidence and hope. How can they get past that stuff of, I stink at this, I feel bad that I stink at it, my church stinks at it? For those who listen with that kind of typical knee-jerk reaction today, give them some words of confidence and hope, please.
Well, I certainly know what that's like, to think, gosh, I'm terrible at this. And I do want to encourage everyone, including myself, that actually what God calls us to do, that actually we can be really good at it. Because it's what is needed today is not someone to recite apologetic arguments for the resurrection of Christ, or to help define kind of in great detail why the God of the Old Testament is the same as the New Testament. That's not the task. And we've framed evangelism as if it's an impossible task that none of us can do, which is why we feel shame, we feel guilt, and we delegate it to the experts. Actually, what I say to myself, what I say to people, is the most powerful thing that we can do today is follow Jesus in public. Follow Jesus around your friends. That's all it is. Just follow Jesus. Live an alternative, compelling lifestyle of Jesus around your non-Christian friends. That's it. That's all Jesus did. He just lived a different way of life around his friends.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I tell you,
so true.
That way of life is compelling to what people are currently living. And what it does, it provokes them to be curious. And often pain comes into people's lives, and that prompts them a bit further to ask you questions. But all you need to do is live the Jesus way around non-Christians. And it will be a profound witness to the person of Jesus. Now, I say to people, well, that means you need to live a compelling alternative lifestyle. That's called discipleship. It's not belief, it's lifestyle as well. Mm. And therefore, that's where the American church and my friend John Mark Comer and others say we have a lot of work to do on our hands, is to live a compelling alternative lifestyle. It's not about giving apologetic arguments. It's about living lives of generosity, loving enemy, being committed to your spouse when everyone's getting divorced, being single and celibate when everyone else is having sex before marriage. It's like, oh no, I'm living a compelling Jesus alternative, because when we do that, it is compelling. And actually, that's all we need to do. And the Holy Spirit will use you powerfully if you do that.
Yeah, amen. Thank you, Gare.
Yes.
Gare, we're thankful for your story. We're thankful for your life, for your life's work. Big love to you. Lots of respect. You're a great model. Thank you for sticking in to this work for decades now. We really appreciate you being with us today.
Well, thank you, Todd. And you know this, we are only here because of you. And so we're deeply thankful for you. So appreciate you. And thank you, Mickey, for everything.
Thanks so much for tuning in to the C4SO podcast. If you like what you heard, please feel free to share this episode and subscribe and leave a review. It helps us to get the word out. Thanks.